Welcome, everybody, to Trashy Divorces, your favorite good podcast about bad relationships. My name is Stacy.
Hey, thanks for joining us today, friends. I'm Alicia. Oh my, today in our Wheel of Trash, it is time to tune the channel to add another sitcom mom to our Trashy Divorces lexicon. This time, it's Katie Sagal.
Peg Bundy!
3 times married, 2x divorced, but that is not even close.
Mm-mm.
To her Trashy Divorces saga. Katie is a fascinating woman, and her history and all of its spiderwebs may surprise you. At last, her love did come along, but what a ride to get there.
Absolutely. So before we get started, there's some magic mirror action going on here, Alicia.
Manifesting some names. I'm going to begin to give some thanks and praise this week to our newest Patreon supporters over at patreon.com/trashydivorces. Holy cats, so grateful for y'all. Kathy F.
Jody C.
Kathy M.
Lacey.
Debbie C.
Stepha R.
Kathy R.
Jessica W.
Ellen D.
Christine R.
Anne Marie C. Huge thanks to all of y'all, to all of our Patreon folks. Getting spider eggs, our little bonus bits at the end, dumpster dives, spider webs, all the good stuff.
We cannot tell you how much we appreciate you and you and you and you for coming to listen today to the tale of Katie Sagal.
Hey, with a big thanks to Melissa O for the amazing deep dive into this episode. Settle in, Trash Pandas. We go long today. There is tragedy. There is triumph. A truly remarkable woman and life.
Alicia, let's go, go, go. All right, Alicia, which sitcom mom do you have for us this week?
Katie Sagal. She is the most fascinating character. We know her as Peg Bundy.
Peg Bundy, yeah.
On the controversial hit, Married with Children.
Sure.
Which ran from 1987 to 1997.
Right, back when Fox hated families.
But Katie Sagal actually has had roles in a lot of films and other television shows. Some of these include 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter, Futurama, Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah, she voices one of the characters in Futurama.
Sons of Anarchy will win her a Golden Globe in 2006. In her long career, Katie Sagal has been in over 100 movies and television shows.
That's
series. Like, isn't that amazing?
It's a really impressive, but yeah, that's quite the
CV.
And
we think of Katie Sagal as an actress, right? She's well known as an actress, but Katie Sagal is also a talented singer and songwriter. In fact, music was her first love, and she had quite a musical career prior to becoming a recognized actress.
Did not know that.
Oh, this story is spiderwebby and amazing. Melissa O did a fantastic job with this sitcom mom. Listen to this. Katie Sagal tours with Bob Dylan, Bette Midler, and Olivia Newton-John, as well as others.
Separately? Or was that like the weirdest billing ever?
Wait for it. We're just in the intro. In 1994, Katie Sagal released her debut album, the first of many. She would also later contribute to the soundtrack for the Sons of Anarchy television show. And Katie's proud of her acting accomplishments and grateful for the success that they brought her, but it was her musical career that had the most impact on her personal life and how she met many of the most influential people in her life, including her husbands. Mm. Katie Sagal has had a lot of relationships, many relationships. Many of the stories of her life after Married with Children may not shock us, but her early life and family history maybe will surprise us.
Okay.
Katie's very different from Peg Bundy, the television mom that made her famous. Katie Sagal is a woman with an amazing life story that includes colorful characters, incredible experiences, addiction, tragic loss, triumphant success, and great wisdom.
Have I hooked you? Yes.
All right, hooked. Let's do this.
That's a gamut. I love it.
All right, Katie's early life and her mother's struggles. We talk about the concept of imago, I-M-A-G-O, and that you're always working something out with the relationship you had previously in the one you're in. Parents, whoa, one of the biggest imago relationships we as humans work out. Most people have no idea that Katie Sagal's parents were both in show business. In fact, you ready for this? Spiderwebs. It was Norman Lear who introduced Katie's parents.
Wow. That's a pedigree.
Norman Lear is, of course, the prolific creator, writer, producer, developer of many of the most beloved television shows of all time. All in the Family,
yeah,
One Day at a Time.
Impactful shows, too.
The Jeffersons, Good Times, Maude, many more. Over 100 shows Norman Lear creates. Norman Lear also nicely, helpfully hosted their wedding reception at Ciro's on Sunset Boulevard in West Hollywood back in 1952. Later, when Katie was born, her parents made Norman Lear her godfather.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Katie's mom, Sarah Macon was Katie's mom's stage name. Sarah Zwilling was a talented screenwriter before becoming one of the first female producers in Hollywood. Sarah was Lear's script supervisor on the Martin and Lewis show when Norman Lear introduced Sarah to Boris Segal, Katie's dad. Katie's dad, Boris Segal, was a respected and talented television director working on such shows as The Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Columbo, Peter Gunn, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., including many others. Now, despite the tremendous talent and promising early life of Sarah Zwilling Segal, her life would take a tragic turn later. In her early 20s, she entertained the troops overseas during World War II. She's a beautiful singer. She even has her own radio show out of her hometown of, right up the road from us, Gaffney, South Carolina.
Sure. Peach butt.
Peach. Yes, there's a very large peach on the side of the interstate. Sarah Zwilling has that radio show out of Gaffney when she's 11 years old. She is known as the singing sweetheart of Cherokee County.
Huh.
Katie writes in her 2016 memoir, Grace Notes, "By the time I was old enough to know my mom, she'd moved far beyond the singing sweetheart of Cherokee County to a life of darkened rooms and hushed hallways, the house's forced stillness when she had taken to her bed. The official diagnosis was heart disease, but I've always thought she had a broken heart." So knowing her mother's impressive list of writing credits on books and soap operas, as well as her success in Hollywood and directing, Katie continues, she writes, "My mom had plans and hopes, more to say and create. However, work came to a screeching standstill when she met my dad, a Russian cab driver by day with a theater degree and an ambition to direct. She loved him. She was 25 years old when in 1952 she tied the knot, an age considered borderline over the hill. And as was expected in her generation, she gave up her career and started making babies. My sense is that parenting paled in comparison with her dreams, and she was never really at home with her role as mom."
Complicated.
Katie was the oldest of five children, but it's important to note that her mother is often absent, at least emotionally, from all those kids. Sarah was diagnosed with heart disease, but it was clear that Sarah was suffering from severe depression. She had a number of suicide attempts.
Wow.
There was a silence and secrecy that surrounded Katie's mom's illness, which will certainly impact the family dynamic. Sarah sees several doctors, takes many prescription medications. Sarah would go away for extended periods to institutions and sanitariums, even tried shock treatments. This is back to Katie writing, "Maybe my mom just needed a job. I felt she was born in the wrong generation. Things were changing slowly for women during the 1950s and 1960s, but wife and mother was still the norm. And when she tried to do what was now expected of her, it broke her heart. All of the treatments in the world couldn't make it okay. She felt silenced." So when her mom would, quote unquote, go away, Katie's grandma would come to take care of the kids, and nobody would tell the kids what was happening. There's no explanation of where mom went during these times. Mom just went away.
This is awful.
Mm-hmm. Katie continues to write, "My workaholic dad neither asked for nor knew how to handle my mom's illness with much more than hysteria and more work." So dad's not a help either.
Yeah.
The Katie's grandma, Virginia Lees Willing, who Katie describes as, quote, "Alabama born, ladylike and soft-spoken, a true Southern matriarch," unquote, would come to their house and grandma would make order out of the chaos. Grandma was calm and unshakable. She took care of everything and knew instinctively what needed to be done. Katie remembers hearing her grandma say, "It's gonna be all right, darling. Don't you worry your pretty little head." So Virginia Lee, grandma, feeds Katie chicken and dumplings and Bisquick biscuits. She teaches Katie how to sew a button, how to iron, how to fold laundry, how to cook, how to write a check, how to mix a martini. Grandma knows Katie needed to grow up fast, and in Grandma's soothing Southern drawl, showed Katie how to take care of herself. Katie's mom, well, and not only herself, but the rest of the kids in the house too, right? Because mom isn't capable of doing it. It's a lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
Katie's mom would eventually come home more broken than when she left, with an ever-increasing amount of pill bottles. And her dad, Boris, would leave for work before dawn, and her mother would sleep until noon, so the kids would wake up to boxes of cereal on the counter for breakfast. It was at least peaceful, though, Katie says, without either of her parents there. That was the time there was the most peace. It's sad, right?
Yeah, this is a tough childhood, and like, the lessons that particularly a daughter could take from this are not great, so...
So it's nice when her parents are not in the home. Dinner is not so peaceful. Katie recalls her mother sitting at the dinner table with her pill box next to her. They would watch their mom pop as many as 6 or 7 white nitro pills, quote, "to protect her broken heart from breaking even further," unquote. Dinner time was also a time of, oh gosh, we love it, arguments and criticisms.
Wow.
Woo! She'll write, "Whatever had been brewing, festering, the air was let out of the balloon at dinner time. As tensions and voices rose, the kids would scatter to their corners with a TV tray and just tried to act like everything was normal." And there were times when things would seem almost normal. When her mom would come out of her darkness for brief periods, Katie would start to feel like a kid again. Her mom would have some energy. Her mom would be funny. She'd tell her how much she loved her. But as soon as those times came, fleetingly, they left just as quickly. The curtains would be drawn. Sarah would take to her bed, tell Katie she wanted to die, and possibly worst of all, that the kids couldn't play too loud because their mom might have a heart attack. Needless to say, this type of childhood had a major impact on how Katie developed, to your point. She will write, Katie Segal will write, "I became accustomed to living on guard, waiting for her to go down the rabbit hole, waiting for the shit to hit. I became adept at coping with high hysterics, managing, rearranging, orchestrating, and waiting, always waiting. I lived with a knot in my stomach. It still knots up. I often have to remind myself that I can let go of it now." When Katie's 12 years old, she lives on the same block as Judy Garland. And Katie Segal will become good friends with Judy's daughter, Lorna Luft.
Hmm.
The girls feel a close bond with each other. Not surprisingly, in large part, because both of their moms had a lot of pills on their bedside tables and both of their moms slept past noon.
Yeah.
So Katie Segal and Lorna Luft hung out together a lot. There was no need in their friendship to explain to the other what was wrong with their mother or why mom was still in bed or hadn't gotten dressed. They both knew. They both understood. Good, good friends.
Yeah. I'm sure there were very few, you know, kids at school who could relate to what was happening. All right.
So Katie always loves music and begins taking music lessons at a young age, and she would write songs and perform in school musicals. Whenever it involved creative pursuits, Sarah, mom, would be able to muster some joy and enthusiasm for Katie's efforts and talents. Katie said that she thought her dreams were, quote, infusing her mom's dimmed life force, unquote.
No pressure.
Right. So one day during her teenage years, Katie suggested to her mom that she goes back to work. But mom always had a list of reasons why that wasn't a good idea, including, at the top of the list, your father doesn't really want me to.
She had been Norman Lear's script supervisor.
Correct. Oh, it gets sadder, babe. I'm sorry. Like, there's... This story really... Okay, Trash Pandas. Let me just set the bar. We're gonna have a happy ending at the end of the story, but there's a lot of the story that is not great. A lot of spiderwebs, but a lot of heartbreak. The family lives in Brentwood, and Katie graduates from Palisades High School. And traditional learning environments were never of too much of a great interest to Katie. But after high school, Katie's father would convince her to try out for the theater department of a school called Cal Arts in Valencia, California. Boris does this by threatening to cut Katie off financially if she does not do this.
So that's not, okay, that's not an offer or whatever.
No, this is, I'm going to cut you off unless you go do this thing. But wow. Lucky for Katie, she didn't need a high GPA or great SAT scores to get into Cal Arts. You could only get in by auditioning. This is a talent-based sort of thing. Katie gets accepted and officially starts studying theater when she is 18 years old. She's doing it alongside some other future recognizable names. Paul Rubens, you know him as?
Pee Wee Herman, sure.
And David Hasselhoff.
The Hoff.
Pee-wee Herman. Paul Rubens was actually Katie's dorm mate in college.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Katie will say that his room looked a lot like Pee-wee's Playhouse many, many, many years before the show even existed.
Okay, I love that Pee-wee Herman and Knight Rider have, like, history together.
More spiderwebs coming, though. Katie has two younger brothers, David and Joey, and much younger twin sisters. Her twin sisters, Jean and Liz Segal, were also actors when they were younger. You may know Jean and Liz Segal as the Double Mint twins for the gum advertising campaign for a time.
Yeah.
Then the two had their own television show, I don't know if you remember this, in the 80s, called Double Trouble.
Rings a bell.
Oh, yeah.
Rings a bell. Okay.
Oh, my gosh. Spider webs. Okay. So, a little bit of a sad bit here, very much of a sad bit. It was the 13-year-old twins, Jean and Liz, that would find their mother dead at the young age of 47 in 1975. Katie was in her early 20s and living in Laurel Canyon at the time, living the life of a struggling musician. Katie had moved out of her family home when she was 17, no big surprise. And because of the atmosphere of the home, Katie doesn't really come back to visit too regularly.
Sure.
She had, however, Katie did, she saw her mom the day she died. She went to visit her mom and found Sarah just to be so different than she normally was. Sarah was happy. She looked beautiful. She seemed genuinely happy to see Katie. Katie recalls her looking glowing and content. She had her hair washed. Her makeup was on. And despite seemingly much improved in her mood and mental state, that night would be Sarah's last. As usual, the next morning, her younger sisters didn't see their mother in the morning when they got ready for school. But this was not out of the ordinary routine at all. However, they get home from school and they creep into their mom's room and they realize that mom had not been up yet. They find their mom dead, covered in bruises and vomit sprayed across the wall above her head. No one really knows what happened to Sarah's willing Segal. Transparency with these issues was not much of a thing in those days, and the longtime family doctor quickly, very quickly, ruled Sarah's death as a heart attack without ever doing an autopsy.
Wow.
That's tragic. So Katie, after a lifetime of hearing her mom say she wanted to die and being suffocated with her sadness, Katie certainly doubted the credibility of a heart attack causing her mom's death.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what was put on mom's death certificate. And years later, when Katie tried to find her mother's medical records just to get some questions answered in her own heart, Katie was told that all of her mom's medical records had all been destroyed. Katie Sagal writes, "I will never know 100% for sure how she met her end. And I suppose it doesn't really matter, but it does explain for me that final evening before her passing. It helps me understand and give resonance to the joy I felt from her and for her. If she had resolved herself to an exit plan, she could have been without her usual anxiety and enjoyed herself, knowing later in that night, she would be successful at last, sad no more. I was kind of relieved for her."
That's, oof.
Okay, gets a little sadder.
Oh, that's great.
I know.
Yay.
Let's talk about Dad.
Oh, no.
Finish up that parent imago to skip.
I'm scared, Alicia.
To skip through to the rest.
Okay, we'll see you on the flip. Hey, Trash Pandas, Stacy here to share my latest take a mental breather from your day find, Two Dots. Two Dots is a free-to-download puzzle-based mobile game where you connect dots in relaxing puzzles while unlocking levels and collecting treasure and prizes along the way. Connect at least two adjacent dots of the same color to make a move, and remember, dots can connect horizontally and vertically, but never, ever diagonally. And as engaging as the main puzzles are, there are also side quest game modes like the scavenger hunt, where you find hidden objects amidst riotously colorful art, and classic adventure game vibes in the arcade. Each fun and relaxing Two Dots puzzle offers a new gameplay experience, plus the chance to collect trophies, medals, and other souvenirs of your adventures. As you advance through the levels, you'll earn various power-ups and special dots with new effects, like erasing all dots of a certain color or clearing a row and column simultaneously, and the colorful visuals find the perfect balance between stimulating and soothing.
Two Dots is free to download, and you can play even when you're offline. Make it a party by challenging your friends on Facebook. If you're ready to kick back and unwind, download Two Dots for free on Android and iOS and start connecting.
Sibling fights are unavoidable, but what if every fight you had was under a microscope on a global scale? That's the reality for brothers Prince William and Prince Harry. They were each other's closest friends and allies since the death of their mother, but that all began to crack as they married and took wildly different approaches to their royal duties.
Wondery's podcast, Dis and Tell, is hosted by comedians Sydney Battle and Matt Bellassai. Each episode unpacks one of pop culture's most iconic celebrity feuds, and they recently took a deeper look into the real reason William versus Harry started.
It's actually much bigger than these two brothers, stretching back into the history of the British monarchy. Did their feud start with the royal family's mistreatment of Meghan Markle, or was it something that started much earlier?
Follow Dis and Tell on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So surely her Russian father is a ray of sunshine.
Boris Sagal was a dominant, if absent, figure in Katie's childhood. She says she loved him, hated him, feared him, and realized that she was just like him.
Okay, gamut. Another gamut.
They would have their best interactions and conversations together early in the day because they're both morning people. Boris was a complicated man, also prone to fits of rage.
So, love it.
Boris was at his best self when he was at work, and he couldn't relax. He still showed many signs of the young Russian boy who had escaped the Soviet Union with his family when he was only 7 years old. Brought into an unfamiliar country where none of them knew the language. And in part, Boris may have become a workaholic because he never got over that fear of poverty and hunger. Financial security was Boris's ultimate fulfillment. And he believed his role in his family was to be a good provider and nothing more. It kind of ended at that point. It was this practical side of Boris, though, that got Katie her first jobs and connections. He knows, Boris does, Dad knows of Katie's rock and roll dreams. but doesn't think it's realistic. Sure, kid, go be a rock star, right? So dad's like, take some acting gigs. You can at least get health insurance for yourself. Mm-hmm. You got to be smart about it, Katie.
Practical stuff.
So when Katie's 17, her dad will cast Katie in a TV movie called The Failing of Raymond, starring Jane Wyman and Dean Stockwell.
Wow.
It was a small part. It only had a few lines, but it gets Katie a union card, which means health insurance. Dad will also cast Katie in an episode of Columbo. And when he tells Katie that he sees real talent in her and thought she had the potential to become a really good actor, Katie doesn't take it very seriously because she had no desire to do that because by this point, she's already in a band.
I'm going to be a rock star, mm-hmm. Dad.
It wasn't until her adult life, especially after her mother's death, that Katie began to really build any kind of significant relationship with her dad. Boris remarries soon after Katie's mom dies and will also sell the family home.
Yikes.
So a year after Katie's mother's death, Katie married for the first time at the age of 22, and her dad throws a wedding for her. She said in retrospect, it was obvious they, quote, dealt with their grief by not coming together, but by attaching ourselves to other people, unquote. But they would continue to make progress building a relationship after their respective marriages. Katie recalls in her mid-20s, her father began to call her out of the blue just to talk and say, hey, sweetheart, just wanted to call and see how you are. It was on these calls that Katie and Dad began to get to know each other, and Katie could feel that he really loved her. His softer, sweeter, older side was emerging. But just get ready for a little bit more tragedy, just as she's getting to know her dad in a meaningful way. Dad also dies at a young age, and also in a tragic way. In May of 1981, Boris Segal was shooting a movie called World War III, and he had taken a helicopter to a location in Oregon, and he jumped out of the helicopter prematurely before the blade stopped completely, and he was on top of a mountain with thin air and became disoriented and walked right into a spinning blade and was decapitated at the age of 57 years old.
I don't even know what to say about that.
It's terrible.
That is like a nightmare.
Terrible. Terrible. So Katie Segal. Plenty of parental tragedy. Let's get to young adulthood, drugs, booze, and her relationship with Gene Simmons.
Ah.
In her teen years and 20s, Katie's life was fueled by drugs and alcohol. She'll rely on drugs and alcohol for a variety of reasons and spend most of her days being drunk or on drugs or sometimes perhaps both.
It was the 70s.
She'd stay up most of the night, sleep all day, and Katie will get a job as a chorus girl in a Broadway touring company of the rock musical called Two Gentlemen of Verona. Hmm. Katie is smoking heavily and taking a great deal of diet pills at this time. And since it's a rock musical, though, Katie feels like it's getting her closer to her dream than just being in theater school. During this time, Katie says it was amphetamines and alcohol that provided all of her courage and bravado.
Well,
during that 9-month tour, Katie has a roommate that would go on to television sitcom mom fame as well, Joanna Kearns, who played Maggie Seaver in the television show Growing Pains. Although the two women, can you imagine Joanna Kearns, Katie Segal, completely opposite. Joanna Kearns will help ground Katie and makes her feel safe with all of Joanna Kearns' wholesomeness.
Yeah, good energy. Yeah.
When the tour was over, though, Katie goes back to living in Laurel Canyon and dealing with her old demons. So Katie is a musician. She hangs around with other musicians who have the same lifestyle she does. It was an unhealthy time, both physically and mentally.
Yes.
As you can imagine, Katie is still struggling through her very troubled childhood, dealing with anxiety. She hates her looks. She feels directionless, broke, and is working as a waitress at the Great American Food and Beverage Company just to make ends meet. And although waiting tables was not what Katie really wanted to do, at least this job incorporated a chance to perform. Because she wasn't just a waitress, she was a singing waitress.
Oh, mm-hmm. Well.
The servers are not required to have any actual restaurant experience, but they needed to have some kind of special talent. So serving you at the Great American Food and Beverage Company could be magicians.
Sure.
Comedians, singers, poets, all kinds of artists worked there and were encouraged to stop everything and just perform.
Dinner and a show.
Yeah, in the middle of their waitressing duties.
Yep.
Over the years, the Great American Food and Beverage Company employs many, many talented people, some of who go on to greatness.
Sure. So,
no restaurant experience needed.
Sure. I'm sure it's a coveted spot for people hoping to get discovered.
So one night in 1975, Gene Simmons comes into the restaurant when Katie Sagal's working. And the band Kiss is fairly new and basically unknown at this time. And they played a gig at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. And Katie waits on Gene Simmons. And Gene Simmons decides that he would like Katie for more than just his waitress.
It also notable that Kiss wore makeup and costume. Like
it, oh, yeah.
They maintained a lot of actual anonymity in the world for a long time.
Gene Simmons wants to date Katie even before he hears her sing, but once he hears Katie sing, he sees how talented, like, Katie is and convinces her to take him home with her that very same night. Katie writes, "I took him home with me that night because he was quite persuasive, and I like men." At first, she thought Gene Simmons was a little weird, but she loved his confidence, and she'll write, "When he paid attention to me, something inside me bloomed." So Gene would go to band practice with Katie. He liked their sound. And Gene Simmons will take them to meet the president of the label that Kiss was on, Casablanca Records. The president of Casablanca at that time was Neil Bogart, and he'll sign Katie's band on the spot.
Wait, the president of Casablanca Records was named Bogart?
Correct.
Okay.
I mean, what? Signed band on the spot?
Yeah.
This is exciting. As encouraging, though, as this is, the first record was not a great success, and Casablanca dropped the band. But no worries. The band's picked up by Elektra Records, and they'll release a single. But alas, that didn't do too well either. So the band started fighting and eventually broke up. Meanwhile, Gene Simmons and Katie Sagal were on again, off again for a few years. Different, though. Katie and Gene are really different. Unlike Katie, Gene is very straight and narrow. He doesn't smoke marijuana. He doesn't drink alcohol. He is a disciplined businessman. Katie said he felt like an adult, and he was doing all the right things to become successful.
It's so ironic that, like, of the two of them, Gene Simmons is the...
the responsible, straight and narrow one. He looks at her one day. Gene says, "Katie, you know what? You're going to be a star someday." And then he paused and asked her, "But do you know what's going to fuck you up?" She stared at him, and he'll continue. "Men, you have a tendency to give it all up for a guy. Don't do that." That's such a relatable thing. Like, people do it, not just women, but like people in relationships all the time. Give it all up for what that is. Katie knew that she and Gene were not exclusive, but Gene Simmons always made Katie Sagal feel really special when they were together. Around this time, Katie started dating a musician named Freddie Beckmeyer. Fairly quickly, Freddie asked her to marry him. Not sure what to do, Katie calls Gene. "Hey, it's Katie. Freddie asked me to marry him. I'm not sure how to answer. I'll say no if you want to marry me."
And he did not want to.
Yeah. Gene Simmons does not answer. He laughs. And she had to accept at that point that Gene Simmons does not want to marry her and that he would never let her lose herself in him and jeopardize the future he felt certain that she was going to have. Katie writes, "I needed this lesson. It was invaluable. No matter how much my relationships struggled or cost me, I never let them stop me. I always kept working." And so, with that answer from Gene Simmons, still reeling in the aftermath of her mom's mysterious death, like these two things are happening at the same time, Katie Sagal will accept Freddie Beckmeyer's proposal in 1977. Now, old Freddie, he's a fellow musician. Katie and Freddie met in 1975 in the LA music scene. The couple date on and off for about 2 years prior to exchanging vows in a private ceremony May the 1st, 1977. This was held in the backyard of Boris's home and Katie's new stepmother. New stepmom, her name is Marge Champion. Have a fun story about her and spider eggs coming up. This home is beautiful. It is in Brentwood. Huzzah! Mazel. Beckmeyer had started a funk band with his brother called the Beckmeyer Brothers. Freddie will also play in other bands like Full Moon, also known later as the Larson Fightin' Band. He'll also play in the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. In 1979, Freddie has a role in Bette Midler's film The Rose as a band member. Katie, young married, continues working as a musician during this time as well. Katie will be a backup vocalist on Gene Simmons' first solo album in 1978. And Katie also has her chance to work with Bette Midler when Katie Sagal tours with Bette Midler as a member of the Harlettes in 1978.
Hmm. So she's working. I mean, she's
Katie's favorite singers had been Aretha Franklin, Nina Simone, Ella Fitzgerald, Etta James. And Katie's always drawn to the emotion and tone and rhythm of black music. When Katie and Freddie lived at what they called the Castle in Laurel Canyon at the corner of Lookout Mountain Road and Horseshoe Canyon, Etta James's band would come over for jam sessions.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. In fact, Freddie worked for Etta James, whom they called Miss Etta. She not only employed Freddie in her band, Etta James did, but she had taken Freddie under her wing, just as she had done with all of her other band members. Etta James's career was somewhat shaky during that time. After having been on top of the charts in the 50s and 60s, Etta James, Miss Etta, is still releasing records steadily, but they weren't landing in the same way as they had in previous decades. It was at the house they called the Castle because of its turret that Etta James first hears Katie Sagal sing. Nervous Katie is to sing in front of her idol.
Yeah, I'm sure.
One of the greatest singers of all time. Katie closes her eyes and just begins to sing. And when she finally opens her eyes again, Etta James is smiling at her. And Etta James smiles and nods and says, "Wow, girl can sing." It meant the world to Katie Sagal. Katie writes, she, Etta James, provided a different kind of musical education from Bette, as well as becoming kind of a motherly figure. She asked me about my relationship with Freddie and gave me sound advice when I asked for it, and in her sweet way, even when I didn't, because she knew I needed it. She appeared to be tough and full of bravado, but on the inside, she was intuitive and caring. In hindsight, I think she saw right through my tough girl stance. She could see my need to be loved and needed. Eventually, Etta James asked Katie Sagal to be her backup singer. So Katie Sagal tours with Etta James and plays all kinds of venues, from stadiums to dive bars. One of the most memorable experiences for Katie was when they played the Anaheim Stadium opening for the Rolling Stones.
Wow.
So Katie will write of her first marriage. "Even though I gave Freddie everything I thought he needed, the marriage didn't last more than a few years. But its unraveling didn't teach me about my own self-worth as much as singing with Etta and Bette had. I kept trying to assign my value by what I could give rather than by who I was. In hindsight, they provided the first in a long line of lessons about how it was possible to be accepted for just who I was, but it would be years before I learned that I could be enough without needing to be needed." I really like Katie Sagal.
Mm-hmm.
Katie and Freddie's marriage will last 3 years before the couple divorces in 1981, the same year Katie's father tragically dies.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
So a lot of tragedy bookending things. That's okay.
Now's probably, we've got one marriage out of the way.
Okay.
Family, parental, trauma, done. Let's take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to get Katie sober. We're going to get her to be Peg Bundy.
Yep.
And we're going to get her to her second marriage. See you on the flip.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
I'm making keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros. Two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
Lauren, we are sisters.
That's true.
And we host a celebrity-obsessed podcast called Pop Apologists.
We also love Taylor Swift. Chandler, how are you managing to cope while we await Taylor's new album?
Look, I want to be put into a medically induced coma and wake up on April 19th, but I'm not sure my insurance is going to cover it.
Join us on our pop culture podcast, Pop Apologists, where we will be dishing on all things celebrity news and deep diving every word and note of Taylor's new album.
Pop Apologists.
Pop Apologists.
Okay.
All right.
Let's get some good things happening here for our girl. By the time of her second marriage, Katie is working as an actress in Hollywood. But as a true lover of musicians, Katie will choose another one to marry in 1986. This time, the lucky guy was Fred Lombardo. But what's Katie doing in between 1981 and 1986, in between these two marriages? Not giving up on her musical career, but adopting some of her dad's practicality, Katie had been steadily taking acting parts. She appeared on the television show Mary with Mary Tyler Moore. The show that Katie was on was directed by Danny DeVito. Her character was Joe Tucker, an irreverent chain-smoking newspaper journalist. The opposite of Mary Tyler Moore's sweet and innocent character. On a side note, there was also another actress up for the role of Joe Tucker. Katie got the part, but that other actress there that was up for contention, Kathy Bates.
Wow.
This is just spiderwebs all over.
Yeah.
During this time, Katie, though, is still deeply entrenched in drugs and alcohol. She's also still playing with the band. She'd be out all night on gigs and show up to the set high or drunk. Her boyfriend at the time was a musician and actor. His name was Spider Middleman. Spiders with the Y,
sure.
Just so you know.
Of course it would be.
Spider is a major player in the punk rock scene of L.A. during that time, and Katie will write, "We were living out a crazy, drug-fueled, bluesy, romantic love story. We were partners on the dark side." Poor Spider ultimately lost his life on that dark side.
Wow, okay.
"I crawled out of the hole by the grace of God," Katie writes.
Okay, so we're not quite through the tragedy yet.
Well, Katie and Spider are regular performers at the Central, now known as the Viper Room, and other L.A. clubs. And during her short stint on Mary, Katie actually escalated her drug use because she's trying to hold on to her identity as a rock musician, but also knows that this job, Mary, is a great opportunity for her, so she'll do even more drugs to stay awake and alert during the day. It's tough.
It's
super tough. Katie was great as the dirty, joke-telling, chain-smoking journalist. She gets a lot of laughs. But the show was not a success, and it was canceled after 13 episodes. However, this show was the tipping point for Katie and her sobriety. She knew she needed to make some serious decisions about her life, or she would end up dying from an overdose. So Katie makes the decision to get sober. And when she gets the call to audition for a new television show on a brand new television network called Fox, it was the first time she had ever auditioned for anything without being on some kind of drug mixed with alcohol.
Interesting.
And even though the television show Mary hadn't lasted long, it was what led her to her big break on Married with Children. The co-creator of the show, Ron Levitt's wife, Shannon Levitt, had seen Katie on Mary and suggested her to her husband, saying she'd be great for the role of Peg Bundy. So in October of 1986, Katie was called in to audition for this new show, the working title of Married with Children when it was being cast. Mm-hmm. This is not the Cosby Show.
Boy, was it not the Cosby Show. Wow.
When preparing for the audition and reading through the script, Katie thought the way that Peg Bundy was described was not exactly how she should be played. Peg was written as a slovenly, lazy, couch potato type of mother, someone similar to Roseanne Barr's character on The Roseanne Show. Mm-hmm. Katie Sagal felt that instead, Peg Bundy should be kind of sexy. So for the audition, Katie wears a tight dress, high heels, cat eye glasses, with her hair piled on top of her head. Katie also adds the idea that Peg and Al Bundy must have, at one point in their relationship, had a very steamy sex life. And even though Al had grown tired of that steamy sex life, Peg longed for it to return. Now, it turns out that the creators of the show liked her sexed-up approach to Peg Bundy, so it gets her past the first round of auditions. So it's down to three actresses, Katie being one. There's another actress there, but the third actress in contention for Peg Bundy, imagine how differently this show would have gone. Rita Wilson, Tom Hanks' wife.
Oh my God.
The three of them get called in. Katie goes in to read with Ed O'Neill, who would play the part of Al Bundy. And the chemistry between Katie and Ed is evident, and the two were cast to play Al and Peg. No one was prepared for the success of Married with Children. It does get off to a slow start, just mostly because people couldn't find the Fox network. But once it does come out, word of mouth for the show is electric. And once it takes off, the media and publicity were off the charts. Now, Katie, though, has a little bit of an extra challenge with handling this success as a newly sober person. Because it really is during this time that Katie realizes just how much she had relied on drugs and alcohol to either magnify or dim whatever was happening around her and inside of her. She had no way of doing that now without the drugs or the booze, so she had to learn new ways of coping. Mm-hmm. So Katie will marry Fred Lombardo, remember him, as the show was starting. Katie's getting used to a lot at one time. Being sober, being married, for the first time being steadily employed. There's a lot happening. Mm-hmm. One great thing, though, that helped Katie to not be harassed relentlessly by the paparazzi like her co-stars was that Peg Bundy looked really different than Katie Sagal did.
Right. Yeah, she was an over-the-top character.
And that wasn't Katie's original plan. Like, that wasn't supposed to happen, but it was a really perfect side benefit of Peg Bundy's over-the-top appearance, her wardrobe, her wigs, because Katie Sagal could go out a little undercover. The Married with Children team was like a family, and Katie feels very much supported. She's stabilized. She's loved in ways that she had not really been loved in her life prior to that. The cast, the crew together are together for 11 years. Everybody becomes really close naturally.
I was wondering, I'd forgotten how long that show aired. 11 years is
11 years. Yeah, that's a long time.
It's a good run.
Unfortunately, though, Katie's marriage to Fred Lombardo lasted only 3 years. They divorce rough. In 1989. And there isn't a lot of information to be had about the breakdown of this marriage, but it isn't too hard to imagine that maybe Katie doesn't have the time or the energy to devote to this relationship in the midst of starring in a brand new hit television show that was garnering so much attention. Mm-hmm. But going through two divorces, does that dissuade Katie from love? Absolutely not.
Nay.
Within a year, she was in another relationship. Let's get Katie to marriage number three. So Married with Children is in its fourth season. At the height of its popularity, Katie will meet and fall in love with drummer Jack White in 1991.
She's
She's got a type. Now, Jack White had had a storied musical career with Steppenwolf, Ike and Tina Turner, Redbone, Rick Springfield, and Katie Sagal knows that she wants to be a mom someday, and she's in her late 30s by this point, and she doesn't really intend to get pregnant after only 3 months of dating her new boyfriend. But that's exactly what happened. Sadly, though, Katie Sagal's first child, a daughter, was stillborn. Obviously, this is traumatic and devastating, and this sends Katie down not only a deep path of grief, but also guilt, right? Guilt is a really common emotion that people experience after a miscarriage or stillbirth because they must feel like it, you know, was my fault. They rationally know it's not.
Yeah, if I had done this or that differently, would the,
So grief and guilt all combined, and the Married with Children crew were incredibly supportive to Katie and wrote scripts that had Peg out of town visiting family. They found a few other ways of giving her a little bit of time off.
Mm-hmm.
Katie finds a support group and eventually is able to make peace with the loss of that child. And even though Katie was super scared to get pregnant again, Katie knows that if she wants to be a mom, she doesn't have a whole lot of time to waste because she's now 39 years old. Katie Sagal and Jack White get married on November the 27th, 1993. Katie gets pregnant right away, 9 months later. August 7th, 1994, she'll give birth to a healthy baby girl. When that daughter is just 9 months old, Katie gets pregnant again.
Wow.
Another healthy baby was born March the 1st, 1996, this time a boy.
It's called Irish twins. Is that the?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
So Katie's personal life, joyful. She's got two healthy kids. Her Peg Bundy years were coming to an end. Fox pulls Married with Children in the spring of 97, honestly, without any warning. It was during the hiatus of their 11th season. So they never even got to make a final episode or wrap up their storylines. It was just over.
Just door closed. Okay.
Katie Sagal writes, "All of us who were involved with Married with Children were pissed and disappointed by how it ended. But with time, the shock wore off. We all got to a place of acceptance. It's almost fitting. Of course, that's how the never a happy ending Bundys would end. Unceremoniously just dropped off a cliff."
Fox had a habit of doing that too. I mean, Firefly is the big example, but
yeah. So a few years later, no big surprise here, Katie's third marriage would also end. Sadly, she and Jack divorce in July 2000, citing irreconcilable differences. Katie describes in her book that the last few years of their marriage were, her words, traumatic and left her in a fog. She also admits that she let the marriage carry on longer than was healthy because she was so determined for her kids to have parents that were married and a stable home. Katie Sagal writes, "The tragedy of breaking up a family was the biggest hurdle for me. Coming from my own non-cohesive tribe, I had fortified myself with the notion that once I had my own kids, a safe harbor for them and for me, all would be right with the world. The illusion of my happy home was the most difficult of my denials to overcome, but my denial about the problems in my marriage had finally lifted." Although there were many likely issues that led to the divorce, addiction on Jack's part seems to have been a major problem.
Yeah, that would be.
Katie describes Jack as struggling with alcoholism, but that he had legitimately tried to stay sober during their marriage. Katie decides to go to Al-Anon in addition for her own AA meetings.
Right, for family members of people. Correct. Substance misuse.
Katie writes, "I had numerous relationships with alcoholics, including my marriage to Jack. Me being the common denominator in all those relationships, I finally realized I could only work on myself. I qualified to be in Al-Anon and related to what I heard in its rooms." In these meetings, Katie started to realize that she, quote, needed to be needed, unquote. Based on her childhood experience, she was so used to and comfortable being that caretaker role that she's repeating those same patterns in her adult life, and she knows that she has to break those patterns. After Katie separates from Jack, Katie said she spent all of her time with her kids or in 12-step rooms. But hey, let's get to a new marriage, a new baby, some new television roles. After Married with Children ends, Katie finds herself typecast now as Peg Bundy.
Sure.
So the next 3 years was a time of inconsistent employment for her. She shot some pilots that didn't get picked up and had some roles on some short-lived shows. Katie had some development deals that never saw the light of day, and as much as she wanted to break into drama, Katie was having trouble being seen that way. So Katie's next long-term job comes unexpectedly as a voice actor for the character of Leela on Futurama, which would end up becoming a cult favorite on Fox.
Yeah.
The show was co-created by Matt Groening, who created The Simpsons. And as some of the first people working at Fox, Katie and Matt had become friendly, which led Katie to being cast. And the show was hilarious, and it was exciting for Katie to learn new things as a voice actor, but Katie still has dreams of working on a drama. In the spring of 2001, Katie meets a handsome man at a 12-step meeting, and he speaks at that meeting, and Katie's struck by how genuine he was in his recovery share. So the two speak after the meeting, and he asked Katie if they could go get coffee sometime, and Katie said yes. So that particular meeting was a Saturday group, and because of her kids' soccer schedule being at the same time as the meeting, Katie didn't return for 4 months to that same meeting, but Katie thinks about that handsome man and wonders if he would be there when she returned. Katie also decided that he would have to meet a list of requirements before she'd even consider a relationship with him. This is smart to do.
Mm-hmm.
Make your index card of what your non-negotiables are, y'all. It will save you so much time in dating. Katie decides her non-negotiables. He had to have a job that was important to him, not be a musician. And that she would not want to be the breadwinner in any future relationship because it created an unhealthy dynamic for the male ego. Sure enough, Katie goes back. Soccer season's back in. The handsome man is there. His name is Kurt Sutter. And he asked Katie where she'd been, and Katie explained. And Katie asked Kurt what he did, and he said that he was a writer. In fact, Kurt was currently on staff for the television show The Shield. So huzzah, Kurt Sutter earns a steady paycheck. So Katie says, yes, I can go have coffee with you. Even though Katie's a little bit reluctant about it because she knew she previously had her words, quote, a penchant for broken dudes, unquote. So Katie, knowing her penchant for broken dudes, should be my cover band name of something because I get that. Katie will ask her sponsor to go on the date with her as a chaperone.
That's very, very smart.
So smart. After a while on the coffee date, the sponsor squeezed her knee under the table and grinned at her. Then she left Katie and Kurt alone to finish their coffee date. And they get to know each other, and then Kurt gets to know her kids, and they take it real slow. In 2004, Katie and Kurt tie the knot. In 2007, they welcome a daughter through surrogacy. They did want to have a child together, but Katie was 52 at the time, so they thought a surrogate might be best for her, like the best option.
Yeah.
She'll write, at first we explored adoption, but that proved to be way more difficult than I expected. We went through the whole in vitro fertilization process and our embryos were not really strong. But we thought, let's give it a shot, and if it's meant to be, it's meant to be, and if it wasn't, we weren't going to do it. But then our little Esme came through. That's why we call her our little miracle, our beautiful miracle. In 2003, so right before this marriage, Katie had been working on the television show 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter with John Ritter. And when they returned for the second season, Katie experiences another tragedy. She describes this one as the worst tragedy of my working life. It is on September 11th, 2003, around 4 p.m., John Ritter starts to complain about not feeling well while on the set. He was rushed to the hospital and died later that day from a ruptured aorta.
Wow.
Katie and the whole cast and crew were shocked and devastated. Katie Sagal writes, I can speak here of how much I loved him, of his angelic spirit, coupled with his deep, dark soul. A darkness he hid well, but I had spied. Or maybe he let me in on. Or most likely, I'd felt kindred to because of my own dark places. John Ritter was the top dog on the production, number one on the call sheet, and the tone he set was love. Just the right combination of laughter and professionalism. The workdays were filled with his insanely brilliant sense of humor. Just enough practical joking to keep the energy high, but also a committed work ethic. So the end product appeared effortless yet precise. He was a comedic master and an angel. I've never met anyone like John, and I feel him around me still in my life. So really, no shit, an angel, is what Katie Sagal says. After John Ritter's death, the network tried to keep Eight Simple Rules on the air and brings in James Garner as Katie's dad and David Spade as her cousin, but it never really got the right combination and spirit back after the passing of John Ritter. The show was canceled after three seasons. Katie's next job, I'd forgotten all about this, was on Lost. She had a recurring dramatic role, finally, as the girlfriend of John Locke.
I completely have spaced that she was part of the cast.
I had too.
Okay.
But the role that finally let her step away from Peg Bundy completely was one written for her by her husband. Listen to this amazingness. So after he finishes, Kurt does, writing the entire 7-year run of The Shield, Kurt Sutter pitches a new idea he had about a show that takes place among outlaw motorcycle clubs. The show he was creating was called
Sons of Anarchy. I actually quit watching it after a particularly brutal character arc of hers. I watched several seasons of it, and then I was like, this is way too violent for me. I cannot keep...
She got her dramatic actress wish.
Yeah, she sure did.
Katie would play the role of Gemma Teller, the matriarch of a motorcycle gang. It was one of the strongest female roles on television and showed an incredibly complex mother-son relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Sons of Anarchy became one of the highest-rated cable shows in history. And in 2011, Katie Sagal won a Golden Globe for Best Actress in a Television Drama for her role as Gemma Teller. As of today, I'm very happy to report, with all of the sadness and tragedy and terrible things that have happened to Katie Sagal in our story, the good news. As of today, Katie Sagal and Kurt Sutter have been married for 19 years.
Wow.
And they're happier than ever. They have both remained clean and sober as well. Katie admits to struggling with aging, saying, my number fucks with me. I think about it all the time. Really, it's always on my mind. I tell myself it doesn't matter, that it's just a number. I don't believe that. It sounds old. It sounds gray, crackly, and saggy. And not sexy. It fucks with me. I like being sexy. Katie is working on making peace with her age and is immensely grateful for the life she has. She will write, I am a girl with a lot of riches. For someone who came of age amid loss after loss, it's remarkable to stand back now and count my blessings. But it can also be disorienting, uncomfortable just to find myself here, having lost my mother when she was 47 and my father just 5 years later. I have no clear concept of aging. I am outliving and thriving far beyond the hopes and aspirations of my parents. And that, my darlings, is the Trashy Divorces saga of Katie Sagal.
Wow. She gets halos, right?
There's so many halos.
Yeah, there's no...
So many halos.
This is not a trash can story.
No, this is definitely not a trash can story. Katie Sagal, all the halos.
Mm-hmm.
On whatever network.
Yes.
Wherever they come. Really kind of an incredible woman. Big thanks to Melissa Oh for that latest sitcom mom in our season 17 of Fun. You're going to be back on Wednesday with something much, much trashier than Katie Sagal.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, goodness. Trash Pandas, I can't tell you how grateful we are for you. Thanks for tuning in today. Thanks for telling your friends about Trashy Divorces, for all the kind reviews, for your support on Patreon. Got a lot of fun stuff there. Don't forget, Patreon people, stay tuned. I got a few spider eggs coming at the end of this episode.
Mm-hmm. Until we meet again, friends, I hope that you will keep your hands just exquisitely clean.
Keep those hearts exquisitely trashy. Big love, everybody. Have a great week.
Bye.
Bye. And thanks to you for listening. Trashy Divorces is a Hemlock Creatives production, created and produced right here in Atlanta, Georgia, by us, Stacy and Alicia, with a little research and writing help from the brilliant Melissa O.
Our art is by Sydney V. Smith. That's Sydney V. Smith at carbonmade.com. And our music is used with permission of Ratsy. Check her out at Ratsy's store on Instagram, and definitely drop into Ratsy's store anytime you're in Oberlin, Ohio.
You can contact us at trashydivorces@gmail.com or find us on the World Wide Web at trashydivorces.com.
If you need more trash candy in your life, our Patreon community includes some of the very best humans around and thousands of hours of bonus content at every level of support. Join the fun at patreon.com/trashydivorces.
Interested in some Trashy Divorces swag? Check out our merch shop and Trash Panda Enthusiasm Society at bit.ly/trashygear.
Want to advertise with us? Reach out to sales@advertisecast.com for more information.
And last but not least, come play with us on social media. I keep most of our Trashy Divorces Instagram hopping. Stacy and I share it up over on Facebook, including our Trashy Divorces podcast discussion group. Come join us over there, and thanks again, everybody, for listening.
Keep it trashy, y'all.